All right.
Oops.
All right, welcome to Lecture 54 in this ancient history program of History at Our House for the elementary class. Julia says the self-test won't come up. I wish you'd told me that 2 minutes ago. But try again. Maybe we can go navigate to the site briefly and see about that. And so anyway, we're continuing with the Greco-Persian Wars, which takes us back to this complicated map here, right? And so we have seen the Persians make two attempts to conquer Greece so far, or at least to attack and to inflict some kind of damage. The first attempt followed the coastline of the Aegean Sea with the army crossing the Hellespont here and going by land, and then the fleet coming and joining them and going here, and then, as we see, being scattered by a storm, and so that expedition failed. So that was attempt number one. And then, well, using the knowledge of the former Athenian Tyrannos Hippias and the Greeks who were commanded to participate in the attack on Athens, the second expedition was, as you can see here, more direct. It came here and then attacked at Marathon. And so that's where we ended up yesterday, with the Battle of Marathon. And we saw that the Greeks defeated the Persians despite being outnumbered because of the double envelopment maneuver, right? In part, right? I'm sure there were other elements to it, but one of the reasons why they were able to defeat a much larger army was the use of the terrain. They were on the upper ground, that's always an advantage, and then also the use of the double envelopment, and they fought them back onto their ships and expelled them at the Battle of Marathon. Okay, so now we get to expedition number three. Both previous attempts have failed, so which one are you going to copy? Which one? Or of course, you don't want to copy either one. You want to do better than both of the previous tries, but which approach are you going to take? We have the new Persian king, Xerxes. And his idea is to go back to approach number one, because he intends to form the largest army ever seen. And, of course, to take an army to Greece, you need to go by land. To accompany that army and to make its expedition successful, you also need a fleet. So both are going to be done this time. And so the army is going to follow that same path that it did before. There's one most efficient path from the regional capital of Sardis. It is to go to the Hellespont, cross there, and go along the coast by a variety of mountain passes and go down into the main part of Greece. So this is the path that that Xerxes' army is going to take. Here's one interesting little thing that you might notice from this map, that the Persian navy comes along, and it's going to go back to that spot that was so dangerous, right? But look what happened, which is pretty cool. It speaks to just the sheer amount of labor that the Persian king could command and so on. Look what they did. Can you read this? Hopefully you can zoom in on it. It says, Xerxes Canal. So what did they do? They, instead of going around this spot, they were probably superstitious. They probably feared going back to this place where so many Persians had died. So they said, all right, we're not going to go there. They cut a canal through this fork of the Chalcidice Peninsula and continued along the coast. So that was now, here we have these two arrows illustrating the path of the combined forces, and they are closing in on the Greeks. All right, now where did we leave off yesterday with the Greek preparations? We said that the Athenians were, after the Battle of Marathon, we said the Athenians were arguing about what to do next. And they knew that when the Persians came next, it would either be like the attack by sea of Darius at Marathon, or the original attack by land and sea. And so they decided that the Athenians would dedicate themselves to preparation of a navy to stop the Persian navy. And meanwhile, the rest of the Greeks, and the Athenians to some extent, but the rest of the Greeks primarily, would deflect or work on the attack by land. So this we call a division of labor, right? A division of labor is where people specialize in one part of a difficult or complex job. And because they specialize at it, they get better at it, right? Imagine if you're a soldier and you need to know both how to organize an army on land and how to organize a navy on the sea. That's being an expert in two subjects. If you are just an expert on naval warfare, you spend all your time and all your energy and you put all your creativity into fighting naval battles. Who's likelier to be better, right, at fighting on sea? Somebody who spends half his time on the sea? Or somebody who's always working on naval warfare? Of course, the specializer, right? So that would be the benefit of the division of labor, would be specializing. And so we're going to see that this actually did pay off in some interesting ways, because we have two attacks. They are together in some ways, but they are separate because one is on land and one is by sea. And so they're going to come now. This third expedition is going to arrive at, here we go, we keep going, to two areas in which you can see those crossed sword symbols, which mean what again? On a map, two swords crossed like at an angle means what? I'm sure I told you yesterday, but if you don't know, it's good that we review it. Julia?
Like that's where the battle was?
Yeah, it's where the swords came together, right? One sword this way, one sword that way. They're clashing, right? The clash of arms. So, yeah, it's a symbol for a battle. And so you can see here is going to be a battle. This is a naval battle. And here's going to be a battle. It's a land battle. And they're going to be fought, as it turns out, on the same day. And it's pretty fascinating because here's a strange fact, and it's kind of an interesting puzzle. The Greeks lost both those battles. They lost them both. And I would say, well, the one of them, the one on land, is the more famous of the two. But if we consider them together, because they do deserve to be considered together, the two battles, in fact, were fought on the same day. And so, in a sense, they were just two parts of the same battle. And the Greeks lost both of them. But if we think about what these two battles represent in the history of this chapter, I would call this the greatest defeat in the history of war. Which, You know, I've already said, I consider this to be the greatest war in all of history. Now, I'm going to add to that, I'm going to say, it's not only the greatest war in the history of mankind, but it is also, it includes the greatest defeat in the history of warfare. Now, doesn't that sound awkward to you? Does that kind of create an image, or do you have some sense of what such a thing could possibly be? What does a great defeat look like? It's a defeat. So that means what happens to the good guys? Patrick?
They lose.
They lose. Okay. So how can you have such a thing as a great defeat? Is there such a thing as a victory? Oh, pardon me. I jumped ahead in my own train of thought. Is there such a thing as a defeat that is good? Or does that seem like too much of a peculiar idea to you guys? Because later on in this ancient history, I'm going to introduce you to another very peculiar idea. I'm going to introduce you to a victory that is bad. So, when you study military history, you better be ready for some very peculiar outcomes. There is such a thing as a victory that is bad, and there's a name for that. Because of who it happened to and what it really represents. And so, can you imagine what that would look like? And that might help you to figure out, well, what would be a defeat that is good? Who thinks they can figure that one out? Patrick, you want to take a stab at that?
Sure. A defeat that's good when you defeat the enemy.
No. When you are defeated. That's the point that I'm yeah. trying to stress, is that the good guys lose. So how could that be good for them? Would you ever want to lose a battle?
No.
Okay, let me give you guys a hint. There's a difference between a battle and a war. Right? How would you express that? The relationship between a battle and a war. What's the difference? What's a battle? You could just describe that for me. Who can give me a definition of a battle? And then on the other hand, what's a war? Sure need some clear definitions if we're going to understand this issue. Okay, Julia, what's your answer there?
Like a battle is when lots of people fight.
Okay.
But a war consists of a lot of battles.
Okay. Yeah, that's the crucial thing there, is the idea that a battle is a part of a war. Right? A war is a collection of battles. A set of battles all relating to the same conflict. Right? And the battle is one of the episodes in a war. Okay, so we can look at it one way, right? Or either way, we have to understand that battles are smaller, wars are the big deal, but wars are composed of or consist of battles. Okay, so thinking of it in that way, can you think of how a defeat in a battle could be good? I'm trying to get you to think of the difference between a battle and a war. And that's my hint to you. Wars are made of battles. How could a defeat be good? Patrick?
Because if it's a battle, you just did one battle. But if it's a war, you only did one battle out of many more that'll probably happen.
All right, you are on the right track. Hi, Sigourney, welcome. So, I don't know if you're trying to raise your hand or you just got your volume sorted out, but put your hand down for the moment. All right, Patrick is on the right track. Okay, so, a battle is just one of many battles in a war. But you didn't quite answer, like, give me a full answer. How could a defeat in a battle be good? So now I'm going to make the question even easier. Ready? How could a defeat in a battle be good in a war? Yeah, I'm giving you more pieces here to put the puzzle together. Now, I know what you guys are trying to do. You're trying to come up with some deep, really deep answer that has all the logic worked into it. It's not what I'm expecting of you. So I'll go ahead and tell it to you, okay? So a defeat could be good if ultimately it helps you to... Finish that sentence, please. A defeat in a battle could be good if... Patrick, finish it off.
It helps you win the war.
If it helps you win the war. Aha! Good. Well done. Okay, so who now can do the old logical flipperoo and tell me when would a victory be bad? Julia can do it.
When it doesn't help you in the war.
Well, no, be more decisive here. When it does what?
I'm not sure.
Because what's the opposite of win?
Lose.
Okay, so you win the battle, but it...
makes you lose the war.
Aha! Now, is that possible? Right? Because can you see how they are the flip side of each other? I think technically we call that the, if you want a good logic term, I think it's called the obverse. So they're two sides of the same coin, right? Because one side is winning, but they're going to lose. One side is losing, but they're going to win. See how that works? Very strange, right? Ooh, it's causing headaches. I can tell Patrick is grimacing.
I don't have a headache.
No, I know. I'm joking that you have a headache because you're trying to wrap your head around this idea, which is very peculiar, right? So Granny, put your hand down. This is what the Battle of Thermopylae is to the Greco-Persian War. So you can see it labeled on here, and it's also on your self-test sheets, so I'm not going to go ahead and type it again for you guys. But it's an interesting word, Thermopylae. Can you see at the beginning of the word kind of a clue as to what it might mean? For instance, look for the same root word in Thermopylae and thermometer. What's the root word? And also, it's the exact root word of a container for keeping liquids warm. Which is what? You want to keep your hot chocolate warm when you go see the fireworks on New Year's Eve. You put it in a... Well, that wasn't supposed to be a hard question. Julia?
Thermos.
A thermos, okay. What does thermo mean at the beginning of words, Julia?
I don't know, but I'm guessing it has something to do with heat.
Yeah, there you go. It means hot. It means hot. So Thermopylae means the hot gates. The hot gates. And the reason for that is... that it is the entrance to a set of hot springs. Has anybody here ever been to hot springs? Hot springs are really cool. Opal, have you ever been to some hot springs?
Yes.
Where?
I don't know exactly where. Somewhere. It was fun. It was really hot.
Yeah, exactly. Water. Yeah, and it's usually
side of a hill.
Yeah, it's usually in a place that's cold, in a kind of in strange ways. I've been in hot springs in the Rocky Mountains, and there are some pretty famous hot springs in Iceland, in places like that. And what happens is there's volcanic activity down below, which heats the water underground, and it bubbles up out of the ground really hot, and it can be really just wonderful to take a swim in that, especially in a super cold place. It's pretty amazing. So yeah, hot springs are like, so there are hot springs at Thermopylae. So that's what the area is called, Thermopylae. It means the gates into that hot area, or the hot gates. And it's a particularly good spot. It was a very good spot for the Greeks to fight the Persians, because it is a mountain pass. Remember how we talked about mountains? Remember how we talked about mountains in Greece and why it's hard to unify? Well, a country like that. Well, it's hard to unify because it's hard to send armies over mountains. Why? Should be a pretty obvious one, right? Sigourney? You there today, Sigourney?
I don't know.
Okay, put your hand down, please. All right. So, Opal?
I mean, it's always hard to go up a mountain, especially hard to take a huge army up.
Okay, there you go. It's always hard to go up a mountain, right? And never mind taking an army up there, right? Okay, good point, right? So you've got to go through a pass. A pass is literally a place where you can pass over the mountain more easily. You don't have to go to the top of the mountain. You go through a little winding path, and you can make it over without having to do the hardest possible way. And so Thermopylae is a mountain pass. It's an area that's still next to the sea where you don't have to climb the mountain. You can sneak past it. And I left you with this question yesterday. I said, well, when is a bigger army not better? Or when might a larger army be a disadvantage? And this is where we get to the story of the Battle of Thermopylae. Here is an awesome picture. Wait a second, I gotta stop my annotations. This is from the movie about the Battle of Thermopylae. You know who these guys are? They look really friendly, don't they? They are the Spartans. And what is this formation that they are in, Patrick?
The flanx.
Pronounced phalanx.
Yeah.
Yes. It is an armored formation where every soldier is next to every other soldier. Is it easy to get through here? If you're the enemy? Obviously not. Okay. How are you going to attack this? It's like attacking a wall. Now, see, in this movie, dramatization is very much like what happened. You've got this rock face here, and then you have the Spartan warriors in a phalanx formation all the way across the pass. How are you going to get through? And the phalanx is organized very deep. So you can see layers and layers and layers of soldiers. And they're all supporting each other. There's a second row and a third row and a fourth row. And they all work together. The guys who are in the second row are helping the guys in the first row not to be pushed back. So even if a big army comes rushing forward and is shoving these guys, it's very hard to move them. Meanwhile, the guy in the back here, he's got his spear ready. So even if you get past these guys with the spear, what's the first thing that happens? The guys over here that are not pushing you are killing you right away with their spears. And they're very organized. Phalanx soldiers understood there was an art to the battle, and they were ready to fight in a certain way, in an order, and they were very, very organized. Very hard to do. So who cares if you have a big army? How many guys can you fit here? Does it matter if you have an army with 1 million men? Where are they going to go? How many men can fight these guys at a time? Pretty much as many as are here right now, right? And who's going to win? The guys who are running and screaming and trying to attack? Very hard to attack this. So the first thing that happens is the first layer of attackers dies right away. Poor guys. I don't envy the first guys, right? And the second layer dies. And then how easy is it going to be for the third layer to attack? Because what do they have to do once the guys in front of them are all dead?
Walk through them?
They have to walk over the bodies of their fallen comrades. Is that easier to do or to have clear ground? And all of a sudden the bodies are piling up. And before you know it, the guys who are attacking are just a pile of bodies and they can't even get by each other. So how do you win that battle? Very hard to do. That was the whole point. And so when the Greeks went to Thermopylae, it was the Spartans who were the greatest experts at this type of warfare. And so they organized themselves. There were only 300 of them, and they were organized under a leader named Leonidas. This is the famous king who led the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae. And they knew that the army coming, the army of the Persians, was huge. We don't know how big it is. Because Herodotus, the Greek historian, says 2 million. But modern historians understand that this is pretty much impossible. Because we understand that in order to move that many people, what do you have to be able to do? Imagine a city of 2 million people on the move. What's their biggest problem? Julia?
Food.
You got to feed them and you got to give them water, right? Now, very difficult to supply and care for an army like that. So there's a science of that. It's called logistics. And it's just all of the ways that you have to support an army on the move. It is very difficult to do. And it's just not possible that in ancient times you could have an army of 2 million men like that. The Persians wouldn't have been able to do that. So it seems really unlikely that they had that many. But who cares? I mean, let's imagine that it's 500,000 even, which would be gigantic. It's a small city moving, right? And you got 300 Spartans, and you have 6,000 Greek allies as well. But mainly, you know, you've got this 300 Spartans at the front, and they are fighting these guys and stopping them from advancing, which is pretty amazing. And they succeeded in doing so for quite a while, but they were betrayed ultimately, which is a very sad story. And so sometimes the good guys in our stories have traitors. In the American Revolution, we have a character named Benedict Arnold. In the Greco-Persian War, we have a traitor named Ephialtes. And he deserves to be infamous, right? You guys know the difference between famous and infamous? What's the difference, Opal?
Famous is like everybody knows about you because you did something great. And infamous is everybody knows about you because they don't like you because you messed stuff up.
Yeah, you did something bad. Exactly. So Leonidas deserves to be famous. Ephialtes deserves to be infamous. They played the opposite role in this story. Leonidas and his 300 Spartans fought this gigantic Persian army and delayed it significantly. Ephialtes betrayed them by revealing a small pass that the Persians could get behind them. They could use that to get behind them. And as a result, the Spartans were surrounded. and eventually they were worn down and defeated. As great as they were, and as capable as they were of fighting using this formation, and the terrain gave them an advantage, they just couldn't forever hold off an army much, much larger than theirs. So eventually they died. And so, now, why do I say this was the greatest defeat in the history of the world? Well, on the one hand, it was most certainly the greatest odds that any army ever fought. In other words, there's never in history has there been such a small force able to fight off such a large force, at least for a while. And on the other hand, an army willing to die. We know how tough the Spartans were, right? They spent their whole lives preparing to die on the battlefield, basically, in the service of Sparta. So this was how they lived. This is what they believed life was. So they were amazing warriors. And they died, and they were willing to die. So they sacrificed themselves, is usually the way that people talk about it. And the point was that they were willing to die because they knew that that was useful to the Greeks. How? How could their death be useful? How could a defeat be good? We already know the general answer. A defeat in a battle can be good if it helps you win the war. Well, how did this story that I just told you about the Spartans at Thermopylae, how could it be good that they delayed the Persian army? How does that lead to victory in the war? How does delaying your enemy perhaps help you win? Opal?
I don't know. Maybe they have more time to prepare in the other areas and they got rid of some of the Persian army.
Okay, two good answers. Yeah. The main answer is that they had more time to prepare. Now, you said something interesting as well. The second thing that you said was that they killed some of the Persians. Not just that. I want you to think about, we talked about yesterday, and I think Rosetta was the one who was talking about the will to fight and how important that is, and what this would do to the Persians. They've got the greatest army that's ever been, the largest in that sense, at least in that sense, right? And they've conquered such a gigantic empire. And then what happens? They come to this place, Thermopylae. There's 300 Spartans there. And what? They can't get past them. So tell me, what does that do? You got this massive army and you can't get past 300 guys. How do you feel? What does it do to your confidence, Opal?
You're very upset because you're huge and you're not being able to get past, and so you'll be very sort of worried and not confident that you'll be able to do it.
Yeah, very.
Or more so.
Yeah, very good. There's a word for that, so I'll give it to you. Very important word in war: demoralized. Okay? To be demoralized means to lose your will to fight. This is one of the most important concepts in war. Oftentimes, wars are won by which army it is that has the most confidence. You see it in sporting events as well. Sometimes you're watching a game, two tennis players are playing, and you see that one's winning. But then all of a sudden, one of the players will win a point, and he will get excited, and the other player will get demoralized. And then the other guy goes on and wins. Well, what happened? Well, the the psychology, we call it, right? The way that people feel of the moment changed. And this happens in all kinds of competitions. And so I like to play a card game called poker. And that is a big deal. Because when one player loses, loses one hand, he often becomes demoralized. And then he's easier to beat after that. And it's the same in every kind of sport or contest. And it's the same in wars. So your desire to win, your belief in yourself, right, is going to be crucial to your success. Having a positive attitude as opposed to a negative attitude is going to be crucial in your success. And so that would also be a factor. That the Persians were winning these battles, but it sure was hard on them. The Greeks were super tough. These were really hard people to conquer. And how many of these victories could you take? Right? Because each time it's so costly and it's so difficult. And now the Greeks have had even more time to prepare. And to leave off for today, right? We have these two battles. We have Thermopylae here and Artemisium here was the naval battle. And in both cases, the Greeks lost, but they inflicted a lot of damage on the Persians and delayed them. And now the Persians are going to continue their advance. And, well, the Greeks now are going to have to figure out what to do. And guess where they're heading, right? Guess where they're heading. Our favorite place. Mm-hmm. The Athens. All right, so tomorrow we'll see. Okay, what did the Athenians and the Greeks do? Because the Persians are coming. They were able to delay them, but they weren't able to stop them. So now what? All right, well, tomorrow we'll have a little bit more of the proof as to why Thermopylae is the greatest defeat in history, because the delay was so important. The demoralization of the Persians was so important. The courage of the Greeks was so important. Their success, in some sense, was so important. And how did all that add up? And tomorrow we'll get to the greatest victory of the Greeks in the Greco-Persian War. All right. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye-bye. Bye.